Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Inside Writing Podcast presented by Gotham Writers. I'm your host, Josh Sippy. As a reminder, all of these episodes are recorded live Wednesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Zoom. You can join us there, bring your questions, sign up for free on the Gotham Writers website, and enjoy the show. Today, we're talking with Aaron Mankey. Aaron is the creator, producer, and host of the hit podcast Lore, the executive producer of the Lore television show on Amazon, and author of the World of Lore book series. He's also the founder of the podcast production company Grim and Mild. Hello, Aaron. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Of course. Yeah. So we want to start right at the beginning with you. So, you know, Lore is this, it's a big thing now, but where did this all begin for you? Like, for you as a writer, what was that first creative spark that sort of kicked off your creative journey?
I mean, if we want to talk about, you know, creative nexus, like for me, it goes back to grade school, probably fifth grade, where I discovered, I liked things as a fifth grader. You know, you're 10 years old, you like things. I was 10 in 85. So I was a kid at the best time, right? You know, E.T., Star Wars, you know, Indiana Jones, all that stuff was all fresh and new. So I was loving that. But it was in fifth grade, I got assigned a short story assignment at the Halloween time, sometime in October, to go write a spooky story. And I think that was kind of the thing that clicked for me, that this mixture of storytelling, but also with building suspense and surprising somebody with something at the end. That was really fun. Yeah.
So was it, I mean, I assume that wasn't the point where you thought, well, this is something I want to do for my life. I want to tell, at what point in your life were you, where this was something where you're like, you know what, this is what I want to do. And were you working like other jobs that were unfulfilled, or where were you as a creative whenever you took that pivot?
Well, two parts to my answer. The first is I have this very distinct memory in fifth grade, much later. I grew up in the Midwest. It was the sort of place where you had to jump in your car and drive like an hour to the nearest mall. And I have this memory of being in the back of my mom's conversion van, you know, the kind with a poker table and mini blinds in it. And she had a friend with her, and her friend brought her daughter, who was also in school with me. And I have this distinct memory of holding a notebook and a pencil and turning to the girl, Cindy, and saying, I'm going to be a writer when I grow up, because I was so in love with what was happening in my brain at the time. I mean, I was just obsessed with that. Of course, life, you know, takes you on all sorts of different paths. And so, before I started Lore, I was probably 7 or 8 years into running my own graphic design business, just working for myself from home, doing logos and branding projects for clients. But in my spare time, as a dad of two little kids and, you know, doing the work stuff, I would sit down in my evenings, probably like a lot of people who come to these sessions you do, and just wrote, because it's what I had to do. So I was writing and self-publishing my own stuff. You know, just that was the avenue that I picked. And it was what I would describe as, you know, kind of creepy, supernatural, thriller sort of material. And I'd put about 3 books together over the years of doing design work and writing. So yeah, it was sort of kind of hovering in the background for me all the time.
And when did the first sort of nugget of an idea for Lore take root? What was it that kicked that idea off?
Well, as a lot of people will nod enthusiastically with, when you self-publish, it's really hard to sell books. So I was getting ready to launch like my third novel that I was going to self-publish. And I realized that, you know, I was going to need to sell a lot of them to recoup my costs. And business was starting to, my design business was sort of, it was entering old age, as far as I can tell. Like I had maxed out all my referrals through all my previous clients, and it was just starting to sunset. So I was looking for something that could contribute income. And I thought, well, if I built my email list base, I had 66 people on my email list. And I thought, man, if I could like turn that into 666, or if I get it over 6,000, whatever, maybe more people would buy my books, and I could somehow like buy the coffee that I drink while I write them. And one of the things that I love to do, I live in New England. New England's this old, it compared to a lot of the country, it's ancient, and it has a lot of mixtures of a lot of different European cultures, a lot of Native American cultures. There's a lot going on here, and it's created this really cool, delicious melting pot of folklore and superstition. I also live near Salem, Massachusetts. So when people think of the Salem witch trials, that's like my backyard. So all of those weird, historically true things are always bouncing around in my head. And I like to weave them into the fictional tales that I write. And I had been keeping an Evernote notebook just full of scraps. Like, this thing happened on this date in the 1800s, and it was very weird, and this is what happened. And I thought, you know, I wonder if I could take like my top 5 or 10 favorites and do like a historical essay on each one, just a real conversational style, like we're talking across the table, not writing it like it's a historical term paper for college or something. And what if I put a bunch of those together and gave them out for free to my newsletter subscribers and said, hey, if you like this stuff, you're going to find elements of that in my novels. And I thought maybe that would drive people to buy my books. So I sat down and I wrote a bunch of them. I think I wrote 7 of them maybe. And I started to have second thoughts because, I mean, this was 7 years ago. Cell phones are bigger now than they used to be. And I remember thinking to myself, people are going to be reading a PDF on their phone and pinching and zooming, and it didn't feel right. So I grabbed the file and I dragged it to my trash can, and I was just ready to quit. I was going to quit writing. I was going to quit designing, go get a job at some office somewhere, and then just resign myself to that for the rest of my life. But there was this voice in the back of my head that said, hey man, you've got a microphone like right over there in the closet. Why don't you record audiobook versions of those essays you wrote, put them in a zip folder, and let your newsletter subscribers download the zip file as the incentive. And that felt a lot more convenient and usable to me. People could listen to that. So I made one of them. The audio was horrible in my office at the time. It was, again, New England is full of these really old, weird built houses. So horsehair plaster, hardwood floors. I had IKEA furniture everywhere. Nothing was soft. It all echoed poorly. And so I put a little bit of music underneath my voice, to like an Instagram filter, you know, just helping it sound a little bit better. And then I sent it to a friend that I trusted his opinion on. We liked the same music. And I was like, well, he'll like this, or he'll at least be honest with me. And I told him my grand plan. And he said, don't do it. That's a bad idea. He said, this is a podcast. And I was like, no, I don't think so. I think a podcast is a couple of white guys sitting around talking for 2 hours about iPhones. Like that's what they were 7 years ago for the most part. He's like, no. There's a show called Serial that came out a few months ago. They're doing storytelling with podcasts, and you've got to understand, like, this is oral storytelling. You could do this. So I took him at his word, and it was about a 24-hour period where I named the show, I branded it. Being a logo designer, it made sense. I created the artwork, built the website, figured out how to host a podcast audio file, got the feed submitted to Apple, and then the rest is my podcast story.
That's awesome. No, there's so many things in there that I want to expand on. How long did it take you to go from like this idea of it being a podcast to releasing that first episode?
Well, I mean, I had that first episode made. I had read places, people giving advice and stuff online for podcasters saying like, you got to pick a regular release schedule. And I thought, well, if that's the case, then I'm going to need to get more of these recorded. You know, so I had a few others that I'd written for the packet of essays. I recorded those. But then I also started thinking ahead that, you know, this isn't a limited series. If I want this to keep going, I probably need to write more of these, which means finding more of these historical things, thinking them through, figuring out the narrative, writing that essay to teach people about them, record it, produce it, and then rinse and repeat. And, so getting the first episode out was really quick because it was done. On its first day of release, I had 9 downloads. So, you know, big day for me that day, 9 downloads. It grew from there, but also at the same time, I was starting to learn the rhythm of like content creation, right? Like I've created a machine that I now need to give. I decided on every 2 weeks. I knew that it would take research and writing and recording and producing. So every 2 weeks fit my level of quality and production that I wanted. And I just kind of got into the groove.
Mm-hmm. One thing I really admire about Laura, the production value of each episode is great. Like the music, the sound quality, it's all very tight. How much effort goes, because I know a lot of people, their barrier to podcasting, it seems like a lot of work. How much work is it to produce an episode?
I mean, it depends on your show, right? Like you think about something like an audio fiction podcast where you've got a full cast of voices, it is a massive lift, which is why they tend to be short run and short episodes, because there's just so much work to do. You know, with lore, I still make mine in GarageBand. You know, I'm 6.5 years into the show, and all I need are 2 tracks. I don't need any fancy tools. I need a track for my voice and a track for the music, and the ability to turn the volume down on the music track. Like that is the bare essentials of what I need. So I don't need a huge like audio setup and lots of, you know, fancy expensive equipment. Equipment and software is what a lot of people who wanted to make podcasts get obsessed with. But at the end of the day, what's more important is getting obsessed with the story you're going to tell, and then you can figure the rest out from there. But I'm very grateful that what I make has a very light production side to it. I will say that 35-minute episode or so that somebody downloads it, once I've recorded it, it takes me about an hour and a half to do the audio production on it, just to get it to where I feel like it's right. And then I lock it. Mm-hmm.
So at some point in this production, you started doing lore, I assume, full time. Were you still doing your graphic design at that point, or when did you make that shift to lore becoming your main thing?
Well, there was a couple of months there where things were a little dicey. I released it in March of 2015, and I ended up taking a contract job. I was writing blog copy for a web design company, and every word I typed, I could feel my soul like leaking out of my body. And I needed it to pay the bills. And so I was balancing that plus the few remaining design clients that I had, with continuing to build up my rhythm for this new thing I had created. And for the first month, my average daily download for the show was about 150, you know, just on an average day, a weekday, 150 downloads. And I had no concept of whether that was good or bad, right? I didn't know if 9 on the first day was good or bad. So I just continued to plug along. I got excited. I released the second episode about a week later because I wanted to get it out there for people. But then I fell into my 2-week rhythm. But it was about a month after I launched it, in the middle of April of 15, we had gone down to my in-laws in the Atlanta area. We were hanging out with them one night. We were watching Fawlty Towers, I remember. And I opened up my phone and I checked the download numbers in my hosting provider, and it said something like 350 downloads. And I thought, wait a minute, that's an error. That can't be right. And then the next night it hit 850 for that day. And then the next day, that day's total was like 3,500. And I thought, what in the world is going on? I thought I broke something. Like a Google search engine bot had gotten stuck on my hosting provider and just kept cataloging the same episode over and over again. What had happened was Apple had picked it. Some human in the company had found the show, said, this is great, and put it in their new and noteworthy section. And it was getting all of this attention on the front page of the, at the time called iTunes. Now it's Apple Podcasts, but all the front page attention going to it. And that's what was happening. And while it's not a magic bullet for a lot of podcasters, like, it's a place for people to see a show and try it, but they might not stick around. They might not hit subscribe or listen to many, but they stuck around and it just kept growing and growing and growing. So to answer your question about full-time, I launched it in the middle of March. I think it was in July that I was full-time. I had reached enough downloads for one episode over a certain period that I could sell ads, and those ads would sell for enough to pay my bills. And so I invoiced clients, stop doing design work, and never look back.
It's fascinating that it happened so quickly. I mean, you launched it in March, and by the summer it was blazing. Was that like the first breakthrough when Apple put it there, and did it suffer any downfalls from there? Was that sort of like just the moment that no looking back from there?
No, it just kept growing after that. Even after it left New and Noteworthy, word of mouth took over. At that point, people started telling their friends, their family members, their coworkers, like, oh, listen to this show, you got to check it out. And it just caught fire. It caught fire. So that was like July of 2015. In August, I was getting emails from literary agents, from publishing companies, hoping I had an agent. I was getting dozens of emails from TV production companies. And by the fall, I had locked in a literary agent, a publishing company, TV company. Like, it was a whirlwind.
So as somebody who had gone the self-publishing route, had you considered looking for an agent before? What was that like to all of a sudden be in such demand by agents?
I had never even given it a thought to go looking for an agent because I had, I think like a lot of people in our community had been told that they're just really hard to get on your team. You know, that agents, there are fewer agents than people need there to be agents. And I just assumed that, you know, being a self-published guy who'd never published a novel before with a big press, there was no hope of me ever landing an agent.
And I assume that this is the agent that led to the book offshoots of Lore.
Yeah.
That sounds like it happened so quickly. Like, did they come to you and say, let's turn these into books?
There were some initial conversations with a publishing company that I liked, but we discovered that it was going to be, again, this was a machine that I've made that every 2 weeks I need to put out an episode. So there's a certain amount of work on my plate every week. And at the time I was just doing Lore, but I was still pretty busy, still doing my own research. And it meant taking on like a book from scratch probably would have been too much. So it was finding the right publisher who understood the value of taking the stories that existed in the podcast, supplementing them with new material, but putting them out for folks that aren't audio folks, right? Getting them out in book format so that people who are book lovers, they're readers, they want that, they can have that. So it was never really meant to be like, here is a new member of the Lore family with this book series. It was more like, there's a whole audience out there that are readers. Let's get these stories that are in audio format over into their hands as well. And a lot of the same conversation went around the TV show too, getting those same powerful stories into the living rooms of people who are primarily TV watchers. The irony in all of this, though, is that the book deal included audio rights. So I ended up going back into the booth and recording all of these episodes all over again for the audiobook. The only difference is that there's no music in the background on the audiobook. So it's almost like it's like Lore Unplugged, you know?
That's great. It's awesome. I mean, you created this storytelling empire that was so attractive to the world that they wanted it in every other medium possible. I never like asking how did that feel, but how did that feel like to all of a sudden have these stories you created wanted everywhere?
There's nothing that can compare to what I was going through in the fall of 2015, you know, through 2016, because TV and publishing, it moves slow. Publishing's a little faster, but it all moves really slow. And it's that kind of stuff where you get the good news and you tell your spouse or you tell a close friend, but you can't tell the world, right? You have to wait until the big company, whoever they are, says, all right, this is the day we're doing our press release. And so I waited months before I could share news. It kills you, but it felt really neat. And there's nothing like, I mean, honestly, whatever the amount is, there's nothing like depositing that first check from a publishing company. Because at that point, you're like, I'm a paid writer, like a press paid me. This is great. So that felt good.
So you're doing episodes every 2 weeks. All writers go through writer's block. Do you ever go through phases where you sort of lose steam or just kind of, you know, I don't know, like again, just lose the steam or run into something like a block in your research or your writing? And what do you do?
Well, I have some weird views on writer's block in the sense that I don't think it is a thing. I think it's a thing for people who they want to sit down at a table and say, all right, what do I write today? Like that's a perfect environment for writer's block, like weeds growing up in a garden that's untended. The way that I handle things is that I'm a plotter, not a pantser. I like to plan things out. So I build a research outline. And with the material in my head from the research, I'm thinking through my narrative. All right, what's act one, what's act two and act three? How do I want to end this episode? What's that little detail I'm going to hide till the end? And in the process of doing that, all of the creative work, the place where I expect the muse to show up and give me all the answers happens when I outline it. And it happens at a real high level. So my day-to-day writing is simply sit down and write my assignment. It's write the words that I have to write today, which, you know, on Monday it's the introduction in act one. On Tuesday it's write act two. I write Act Three and the summary on Wednesday. Thursday, I write the epilogue. And then Friday, I produce the episode. Although I'm playing with that a bit in this coming season. There's no seasons to lore, but I write by seasons. I write really quick. If you can tell, that's a 1 week swing for an episode. So I write one a week, and then I take a handful of months off to work on other projects and do stuff. But toward the end of this last writing season, back in May, I was writing two or three episodes a week. I would sit down and I would write an entire episode in a day. I was thinking to myself, why in the world is it taking me a week to write 5,000 words? Like, this should take me a day. So again, I think that the writer's block happens when you don't go in prepared. If you go in prepared and I know I'm starting at point A and point B is over there, I just got to get myself there. Then you write. And so I encounter a lot less block because of that. Again, this is a lot different than writing a novel. We held a writer's room once a year, a model I borrowed from TV. I get all my researchers together. I ask them months ahead of time, go find stories that you think are lore worthy. And we gather together in the first week of January and we throw ideas at each other. We used to do it in person. Last year, we did it all virtual. And we walk away from that with about three dozen topics that are set. You know, we've dug into sources to say, yes, there's material here. We've discussed the micro outline, what's in basic terms, what's act one, two, three, and the summary and the epilogue about. We got it all locked in a document in Google Docs, so that when it's time for a researcher to research it, they just kind of pull that file, that's their starter doc, and then they run with it. And then they hand it to me and I read it and I write it.
That's the perfect segue into my next area of discussion, yeah, which was the research behind these. Because there are a lot of stories of mythology and stuff out there, but yours go like deep into little niches that most people probably haven't heard of. So your ideas, you send people out there and you say, just find ideas, and then they bring it back to you. Like, how much research goes into this?
So, the fishing expedition to get material for Writer's Room is all about, go find me stories that you think are really cool, that you think would be entertaining. And then as a group, we'll sit in Writer's Room for an entire week. You know, we'll spend 9 to 5, Monday through Friday that week. Carl will stand up. He will pitch his pitch. Here is the story. This is what I see the flow being. What do you guys think? And we'll discuss as a group and we'll say, well, I like that part, but this part over here doesn't work. And we get it figured out. And then once we're done, somebody usually who pitched the topic will write in a Google Doc. They'll create a folder, topic X, and then they'll create a doc in there that has act one, act two, act three, starting sources, material that we all bumped into as we were discussing it. Like, oh, look, there's this article on JSTOR, a historian from 1905, covered this in an essay and there's great material in here, that kind of stuff. We go get, but then it's tricky. You're right. Because it's doing enough research to know that it's viable, but not enough research that it's the official research phase. So all of those go into drive. They get sorted, organized. I try to get a little rhythm going in lore. We do like people, place, thing. And then when it's time for a researcher to do it, the materials they have are ready. I think I have 7 people, maybe 8 people who do research for lore. Some more often than others, but yeah. And all of them have different backgrounds. One of my researchers, her master's degree is in medieval witch trial documents. So if we have an episode on witchcraft, you guarantee that Allie's the one who researched that one, because you don't want anybody else to research it. She's the best.
Right.
That kind of stuff.
So when did you, cause I imagine at the start, it was all you doing the research. So when did you make that move to start pulling in help to help you with it?
I want to say around episode 50. And up until then I needed those 2 weeks because it was like the first week was finding the topic and researching it. And then the second week was writing it, recording it, producing it. So that set my rhythm. There was a point when I brought on enough researchers where I did say to myself, could I start releasing weekly? But that also meant writing twice as fast. And I'm not sure I was ready for that. So yeah.
So, at some point this spawned the Grim and Mild podcast. I'll call it an empire. I don't know if that's the correct term, but that's what it feels like, where you've got all these similar natured podcasts all under the same umbrella. So at what point in your journey did that become an option? And when did you move on that?
So about 3.5 years ago, I got approached by iHeartMedia. I got approached by How Stuff Works, because that was before iHeart acquired How Stuff Works. How Stuff Works used to be a website like 15 years ago that wrote about how stuff works, right? It was like articles about, you know, how do funeral homes work, or how does molecular biology work? And they would do these web articles, and it was a great place to go learn. And at some point, the guy that ran the company, a guy named Connell Byrne, said, what do you think about us turning these into these audio stories they call podcasts? And so they took some of their material and they created a show called Stuff You Should Know, which has been, I don't know, downloaded a billion times. They've done over 1,000 episodes. It's one of the OGs of the podcast world. And they're just, Josh and Chuck are amazing guys, and they continue to crank it out. They do it twice a week too, which is just fantastic. So they had built their own little How Stuff Works podcast empire. And they came to me and they said, we love what you create. Would you create some stuff with us? And I said, yeah, let's do that. So they provide the production resources. I provide the ideas, the writing, the voice, to some degree on different shows. The first show we launched was 3 years ago in July, called Cabinet of Curiosities. And then shortly after that, we launched Unobscured, which was, they all sort of fall in that ballpark of like the weird and the historical, but there's a sliding scale there. And so Unobscured is like, it's a lot more historical than it is weird. Its idea is, let's take a historical topic that people think they know, but they actually don't. Like, ask anybody about the Salem witch trials and they'll say, oh yeah, people ate rotten bread, didn't they? And they went crazy. No, that's not it at all. There was a theory for 1 month in 1976, and then it was debunked, but it's what everybody remembers because it's easy. And so that's the idea behind Unobscured. Like, let's take a topic that people think they know, and then they walk away and give them the actual material on it. And it's been really fun to do that. And the Cabinet is like lore, but it's like bite size. It's, you know, 4 minute stories. There's two of them in an episode and they come out twice a week. So I made them, I feel like there was another show in there, but that deal was for a year. And at the end of it, they were like, this is good. Let's make more. And I said, all right, I need to put all these shows we're making under a company umbrella. And Lore I have kept as its own company. Because Lore has lots of satellite things floating around it, the book, the TV show, all that stuff. So I created Grim and Mild to be sort of the corporate home for everything else that I make. And so that's been going on for, you know, all those shows together for over 3 years. And I think at this point there's like 10 active shows. We've got more in pre-production and I stay busy.
Which, again, great segue. Again, I was going to ask you, you know, because you host three of those shows, I believe, Cabinet of Curiosities, and I think Unobscured as well. How do you stay organized in all of that? I mean, for most writers, it's like one project, maybe two, but here you are, you're running this company, you're still writing the stuff for these episodes, for three different shows. How do you stay organized?
Part of this is that old, you know, cliche of turning the temperature on the water up on the frog slowly. You know, I didn't have to go from making Lore to making 10 shows. I went from Lore to making two and then three. So it's been this slow progression. Part of it is having a team around me to help make that possible. You know, Unobscured is researched and written by people who aren't me. I wrote the first season, but realized that I just somebody else needed to do that for me, who is a lot more qualified. So Carl, he was researcher number two for Lore. He has a really good gift at writing in my writing voice, so that when I narrate it, when I get in the booth and I record it, it sounds like me talking. Harry, who writes Cabinet of Curiosities, does the same. He's gotten very good at writing like Aaron. So when I read it out loud, it sounds like I wrote it, or at least it feels right on my tongue. If that makes sense, my mouth likes it. It doesn't feel awkward. Pick up like another author's book and try to read a paragraph out loud, and you'll know what I mean. Like you'll bump into things like, oh, that rhythm, it feels weird to me. But it's not weird rhythm. It's just not what you're used to. So having writers that can write in my voice is super helpful. And then another thing that helps me is that I'm just really obsessive compulsive. I have a to-do app that syncs between all my devices. I'm very good at capturing ideas. I have a notebook and I'm in my mid-40s and I've realized that if I don't write things down right now, I will forget it. It is a guarantee. I will forget it. So I write everything down.
I want to pull in some questions from the audience now because there's some good ones piling up here. So first question, you said when you first created Lore, the nature of podcasts was different. Podcasts like Lore and Serial were some of the first to change that mold. All these years later, how do you think the world of podcasting has changed? And second question, what would you change if you were starting a podcast now?
I mean, it has changed dramatically. One of the reasons why I had the attention and the exponential growth right away is there were fewer podcasts back then to not compete with, in the sense that like there could only be one good history show. That's bunk. There could be hundreds of great history shows, but in the sense that people only have a limited amount of listening time in their life, right? So back then there were fewer shows to compete for that listening time. And I don't remember the numbers. In 2015, there were maybe 500,000 podcasts that were out there and active. There's over 2 million today. It's so, so much bigger of a space. And that's good. I think that what's happened is people like me early on have realized this is a great place for storytelling of all kinds. We can come in and we can do really great journalism on important topics. We can do documentaries. We can do comedy. So it's growing. And the second question, if I was going to start a podcast today, what would I do differently? It's tricky because I start one, I feel like, every day. But the newest show that we released back in August is an audio fiction. And I think that it's almost like my life has come full circle, where I was writing fiction in my evenings. I took pieces of it to make a historical podcast called Lore. And then all these years later, I'm making a audio fiction podcast that is based on the historical material from Lore. So that feels to me like the natural evolutionary progress for my creative brain. And it's fun.
Next question. Hi, Aaron, huge fan of your work. Have you ever researched something only to find the story is difficult to tell? Do you scrap the idea or use other tactics to inspire?
I scrap all the time. The hope is that the scrapping happens in the writer's room, where a bunch of minds who they understand the way that Lore stories work, the way what we're looking for, that all of us together can look at the material and say, that doesn't work, let's move on. And having the courage to say in a room full of people who are passionate about their material to say, I know you love that topic, but it doesn't work for a Lore episode. We try to use the whole buffalo in a sense. So like an episode idea might get scrapped and not you turn into its own full episode, but we may take that topic and put it on a spreadsheet somewhere else and say, down the road, we're going to need 2 pages on that topic and we'll pull that then and we'll use it. But we just can't do 35 minutes on it. You have to be picky and it is frustrating. I have probably on less times than I can count on my hand, started writing the episode, having read the research, only to realize this doesn't feel right. It just doesn't feel like a Lore episode. And in those moments, you just have to have the integrity to say, I want to be true to what this show is supposed to be. So I have to walk away from this. And it's painful when it happens because I hate wasting time, but you have to do it sometimes.
So I'm curious, and you might not be able to expand on this anymore, but what is it that makes it feel like it's not right? Is it just that you can't fill enough time about it, or it just doesn't feel like it's the Lore voice?
I don't know. At the end of the day, a lot of it comes down to my intuition. When I read the summary of the story, does it tick all the boxes that I haven't defined? And that's why, the buck has to stop here, because I've set the bar at a place where it needs to be without not knowing where that is. And so I couldn't ask other people to just go out, pick a topic, research it and write it, because I have to vet everything. And yeah, sometimes they just don't feel right. It's just an intuition thing.
Next question. What do you do about disagreements in the writer room?
I mean, I win. That's natural. These are folks I trust with story material. And if they come in and they say, I know you don't like it, Aaron, but let me pitch it a different way, or maybe let me use different words to get you on this. I'm 100% open to having my mind changed. And it's happened a number of times. We did an episode a couple of years ago on, we tend to deal with folklore, superstitions, places where you find instances in history where people have let folklore drive them to do things that are, maybe aren't logical, like, you know, Michael Cleary burning his wife Bridget in the fireplace of their Irish cottage because he thought she was a changeling. Like, that is folklore driving the real actions of a person. But Carl pitched me an episode on parasites. And I thought, this is interesting and it doesn't feel right. And he said, well, bear with me. Let me work with you on this. And, you know, honestly, there's a lot of good horror tropes based on bugs. And there was a lot of folkloric belief about the insect world and parasites in early medicine, Middle Ages on up. And then we sort of end it on an Act Three story that is about, it's about two things. It's about a real parasitic infection in Africa in the 1800s, but it's also about colonialism of white people coming into Africa and pushing and taking over everything. So there was parasiticism on two levels, and that felt very appropriate. It was like this idea of being a parasite, which literally means like unwanted guest, I think, in Greek. It existed on multiple levels at the same time. So he sold me on it, and it worked.
Next question. What gave you the idea or spark to move from single narrator podcast to creating a full cast production like Bridgewater?
It was always there, you know, writing these novels before. It was just a matter of waiting for companies to catch up in the sense of wanting to put the budget there to spend money on it, hiring good cast, doing great production. And Bridgewater does that. I mean, I realize there have been a lot of audio fiction podcasts before it, and there will be many after it, but I'm really proud of Bridgewater because it's sort of, again, it's full circle for me. It's my supernatural thriller, old days brought back to life, and then like packing it full of lore goodness. So it's been fun.
Next question. Hi, Aaron, fellow podcaster here. I'd like to know more about the original steps you took to market the show and grow your audience.
Luck and word of mouth. I get a lot of eyes rolled and I frustrate a lot of people when I tell them my marketing advice, but my marketing advice is this. You probably learned about the last show that you streamed on Netflix or Hulu or whatever, because a friend told you about it. Somebody online is telling me that I need to go watch, what is it? All the Murders in the Building, or the one with Steve Martin and Martin Short and Selena Gomez that's out now on Hulu. What We Do in the Shadows is another great example. Somebody said, you've got to watch this movie. And that turned in, we learn about the things that we end up loving because somebody we know and trust loved it and told us about it. Like, that's just a general accepted concept. That's how word of mouth works. It's the water cooler moment. It's social media. Word of mouth works. So if folks love what they hear, they're going to turn to a friend and say, you've got to listen to this thing. It's really good. If people aren't turning to their friends and recommending your show, then that means they don't love it enough to recommend it. This is math. This is like emotionless logic work here. So if nobody is sharing your show with their friends, it means that you need to change something about your show to make it more shareable. And I don't mean sound bites or marketing tricks. I just mean making better content, tell better stories, get people more excited, have them feel thrilled and empowered when they get done listening, make it worth the journey for them. And they'll say, damn, that was good. I need to go tell somebody else about this so we can talk about it. It's going to be great. That's how shows grow. It still is. You know, paid marketing doesn't do anything near what word of mouth does.
Next question. Do you sometimes improvise or just stick with the written part in your podcast?
Oh, no, I never improvise. It's all pre-scripted. That's half the reason I ask for questions ahead of interviews like this, is because I want to think. But for lore, when I say I write an episode, I'm literally writing a script. I'm writing what looks like an essay. I format it in a way that helps me in the booth. Things like phonetic pronunciations for certain words are bolded and in bright orange, so I see them and know they're coming up. I use punctuation differently to sort of tell me when to take a break, take a breath, pause, all that stuff. But I'm writing the script. So when I get in the booth, I set my iPad up in front of me, I hit record, and I read it word for word. I did all my thinking, all the processing for the story happens at the keyboard. So when I get in the booth, I'm just recording.
So here's a question I'm interested in too. Did you ever get worried that you're going to run out of interesting stories?
I did. Yeah. I got worried back in 2015 after those first few that I had written were done and I was working on more, I thought, oh, this is hard. I'm going to run out of stories to tell. But it hasn't happened yet.
Do you have favorite authors, researchers, or historical sources?
Oh, like, I guess, far as for lore material, every topic is different. It's so funny. I mean, you would think that like, this is my job. And so there's a workbench full of tools and I always pick up like my five favorites, but it's not the same. You know, we did an episode this week that was on people centuries ago using folklore as a con artist tool. There's this creature from English history, English folklore called the Barghast, which was sort of a goblin slash ghost shapeshifter. It's sort of a catch-all for things. And it was common that if a Barghast was seen that you were in trouble and you needed to get away. And so this guy was dressing up as a Barghast, scaring farmers, like jumping out of the bushes, scaring farmers. They would leave their house. He would go in, take everything of value, and they'd come home. And the folklore said that the Barghast would steal your stuff. So of course it's all gone. Like it all made sense. And it perpetuated the belief. And then he would wander down the road and pull his mask off like a Scooby-Doo episode, right? And it's amazing stuff. But for his material, a lot of his story was found in local contemporary newspaper accounts because it was like a localized story. And we had a number of those. But then sometimes it's like a global topic, like stories and mythology about little people that is all over the world, Indonesia, Ireland, you name it, they're everywhere. You can't just grab a newspaper clipping and work on that. You have to go to scholarly works that are doing comparisons and anthropology studies. And every time we sit down and do a topic, we kind of have to sit back and say, all right, what's the best approach for this one? But that said, books.google.com lets you search the text of millions of books. So it'll help you narrow down, do I need to pick this book up or pick this book up? And then you find out, oh, it's this one. And you can go buy or check that one out at a library. JSTOR, again, JSTOR.com is a scholarly library of like journals where historians or experts in their field have published. And that goes back decades. Those are good resources.
And there was a follow-up to that question, which I wanted to ask as well, which is, what is your favorite episode that you've done? Do you have a favorite?
It's like picking a favorite kid. It's so hard. It's usually the most recent one I've written because I get so excited about them when I'm writing them. But I will say that there's an early episode. We actually just released it as a remastered recently called Half Hanged. And it's about a woman accused of witchcraft in colonial 1600s Massachusetts. And I love the story because she comes out of it in a very unexpected way. And it's just like this, all the forces that brought about the witchcraft panic and the way that women were treated, primarily women, like 95% women. This woman's story kind of throws the bird up. And I love it. There's something about it.
So a tech question here, and there's actually two of them, so I'm going to lump them together. What type of equipment do you use and has that changed a lot over time? And then second part of that is, where do you record? Do you have a booth in your home?
So for the first, I don't know, maybe eight episodes or so, I recorded on a Yeti, which is a cheap USB mic you can buy. Looks like a silver bullet on a stand. And I recorded, It gets the job done. Again, I'm not an equipment snob, but I recorded with it in front of my glass screen of my iMac on a wood desk. You could, like, early episodes, you can hear thumps when I put my elbow down on the desk right next to the mic. I think it was on a box to prop it up. Like, it was super low tech. But around episode 8 or so, I think I upgraded to, again, not an expensive mic. I bought an SM7B from Shure. It's probably, I think the Yeti's a little over $100, or maybe it's 200. The prices have changed over the years. But the SM7B is under 400, and it's an XLR. So it plugs into one of those like mic cables that people would see at a concert. And that goes into a box that I have from Focusrite. And then that comes out as a USB into my laptop. And the mic, the Focusrite, and the laptop are all in a closet in my office over there. My office used to be a master bedroom in this house. So it has a nice big walk-in closet. And inside is not the fanciest thing in the world. It is literally a PVC pipe frame that's about 7 feet tall, 2 foot by 3 foot, with moving blankets that I have clamped around the booth and on top of it, because moving blankets are great for deadening sound. All of that to say, the mic is less important than the place you record in. If you can record in a space that deadens the sound, that keeps it from bouncing around like light wood in a house of mirrors, right? So go into your coat closet with the mic you have and record a test in there. And you'll probably discover that the mic's not the problem. It's the environment you record in that's the problem. But yeah, at some point, if somebody wants to buy a better mic, it's a good upgrade, but I don't think it's as important as writing a good story.
Yeah, I can say the Yeti mic has done well for me for years. So it's a good one. How would you describe the leap from writing podcasts to creating television episodes? And a caveat to that, how much were you involved in the direction the episodes took?
Season one, I was very involved, and I didn't write the scripts, but it's a neat process to take something that in a sense, written as a monologue that you could give anywhere from a stage or a microphone, and turn it into something that's very visual, and finding new ways to do that, especially season one of the TV show, where we're weaving in visual documentary elements, found footage, animation, and things to step out of the story for a moment and teach some context. Here's your 3D glasses, you know, that you can see more of the tale with. Now that you know this, let's go back into the story, do more of the story, and then pop out for more context. That is a neat process. And you learn a lot going through that. I would say that it prepared me a lot for the audio fiction projects, because they have a lot of DNA that's the same. So I'm glad I had a TV experience to go into something like Bridgewater, kind of primed for it.
The question, I'm going to expand a little on this question. It's, when did you bring Chad Lawson on board? I'd also just like to caveat that, where do you get your writers from? Like, do you hire people, or are they people you know?
Everybody that works with or around me has sort of like just fallen into my orbit at the right time. Like, again, Allie, who she's my medieval witch trial document expert. I bumped into her 2 years ago on a subway in Boston. My wife and I had gone down to see the Raconteurs, and we found a couple of like older Midwestern guys had cornered some young college gal in a corner where they're asking her like, "Oh, you're going to be a teacher?" And she's like, "No, I'm a history major." Like, they just assumed it's a woman in college, she's going to be a teacher. And when I heard her drop, you know, the term medieval witch trial documents, I kind of slid in and said, "Hi." So people, they just like the folks that work with me, it happens. Some are people I knew before lore, some are not. For me, it's more like, what skills do you bring to the table? What's your experience, or how good of a learner are you? You know? And as far as Chad goes, I think Chad came in, I want to say in the 50s or 60s on episode numbers as well. But not like full episodes. And then as we got to know each other more, and today he's my best friend. Like, the years have been good to us. So he's just written like albums worth of material for me to use. And that's my base right there.
And then how do you handle citations for episodes? Do you list everything you use?
Well, that's the weird thing about audio historical shows, is that like, I don't know that anybody wants 5 minutes of me reading a bibliography at the end of an audio episode. It's just, nobody does it. It's not the format for it. But if you go to the website, go to lorepodcast.com/episodes and, you know, pick an episode. The newest one, I think it's 179. Underneath the little player, you're going to see episode music and episode sources. And you can click the episode music to see the list of the song names from Chad that we used. And the episode sources page that you'll go to will have the bibliography. So it's always been there. It's there. My publisher was super happy about that. We put all I was writing them originally as footnotes when I was first writing Lore, and then they became just sort of an endnote thing. After the publishing project, I realized, oh, endnotes look a lot better. They don't clutter up the script. I don't have these little super script numbers in there that confuse me while I'm reading the script. So yeah, but to answer the question, in a sense, like when I'm writing the episode, it's almost like I'm writing the term paper. Like, all right, I've used this material, go to the end, put in the person's bibliography information. I do my best to, if somebody's work is like, they own the field, they're a historian that simply there's nobody else in the space doing their work. I will actually do a little call out in the credits and say, look, we've skimmed the surface, but if you want to go deep, this person here is the one to dig into, and here's their book. And we'll reach out to the author if they're alive and say, where would you like us to point people? Your website, Amazon, your publishing site, what is it? And so we'll direct people that way. But for the most part, we're using 20, 30, 40 sources in an episode.
So that's all the audience questions. I want to cut into one question that I really wanted to ask, which is, do you have any, what's next for Lore? Like, are you going to do like a video game? What else can Lore do?
There's been little things here and there. You know, we've got a neat little collaboration with Apple Maps, where you can go into your Maps app on your iPhone, your iPad, and you can type in Lore Podcast. And we've got a few like, I don't know what I want to call them, thematic collections of locations on the US map, like haunted cemeteries or haunted Baltimore, haunted Boston. And so we'll do more of those in the future. I want to get back out and tour again, but you know, this last year and a half has kind of been brutal for touring plans and live stuff, and doesn't feel right yet. I've got a kid who can't be vaccinated yet because she's too young. So we'll get back out there. And then, you know, right now for me, it's just like, let's just keep making the show, keep making episodes we love. And then I've got other fiction projects that are in the works too. I've got a lot of irons in the fire, but, thankfully I am very organized.
As we've learned, do you have any parting advice to people who want to, you know, being a career creative is a dream for so many people. Do you have any parting advice for people that want to follow in the kind of footsteps that you've made?
You know, I just think back to my story, you know, if folks didn't catch the very beginning, that I almost quit this, right? Like I literally dragged the file that became Lore to my trash can. And before I let go, I thought I could try it a different way. So my advice would be, don't give up, but be willing to be creative in how you put your dream into action. You know, I wanted to write fiction, but what I changed over time, and the concessions that I made, or the way I let it evolve, let it become something bigger. I'm still writing for a living, you know, at the end of the day, that's what I wanted. I just had to be flexible with how that came about. And so don't be rigid with every aspect of your dream, but don't give up.
So then very last thing is, I'm sure most people already know how to find you online, but do you have a Twitter? Where can people find you?
You know, they can go to aaronmankey.com. They can go to lorepodcast.com. And all my social handles are on there as well.
Awesome. All right. So to all of our listeners, we are off next week, but we're going to be back the following week talking to Aaron and Trotta Kelly about her children's book career. So until then, Aaron, thank you so much for being here today. This was great.
Thank you so much. This was fantastic. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. So to all of our listeners, we will see you next time.